The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good Monday morning. It's Monday the 29th of May 2023, just approaching 5 minutes past nine, and you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show on this beautiful sunny Monday morning. And such is the way the weather is forecast now, they're telling us that it's going to be like this all week and through next week's long weekend. So that's something, if you are into it and you can get out and enjoy it, that you're going to be delighted to hear, isn't it? And what a great weekend it was as well. We had an amazing night last night in the Mount Errigal Hotel. Fair play to the staff and management down there for hosting so spectacularly the fantastic Highland Radio Customer Services Awards. Congratulations to the 50-plus businesses from all across the region that picked up a prize on what was, I think, a fantastic night. I bailed early so I could be here, of course, but I would say it went on for quite some time after I left. And that topped off a great Sunday, particularly too for the Donegal ladies. A big congratulations to them. Lovely to see the odds upset. They beat Armagh a goal and 10 points to 9 points yesterday. They are the champions again, and a fantastic result. And we'll be talking about that and so much more besides with Brendan Devaney when he calls in to preview the DL Debate podcast. So we've loads coming up on the show, so stay right where you are. What do you want to talk about? Is there something from the weekend that you want to raise with us? A bit of good news that you wish to pass on? Whatever it is. If we want to say hello to someone too, by the way, we play requests a little later on in the show, so get them into us. 08660 25000, that's the WhatsApp and text number, 08660 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. So let's run through the front of the newspapers this morning and the inside of some of them. We'll start with the Donegal News, and staff at Letterkenny Childcare Facility are being forced to urgently find a new premises because their current building has mica. Management at Letterkenny Community Childcare Centre have launched a major fundraising drive after their Liscannon building was detected as having 35% mica. They're now in the lookout for a new site or a suitable location which will allow them to stay in business, and they're launching a major fundraising drive as part of their campaign. The Derry News this morning tells us that two organisations in the north have raised concerns regarding the PSNI's most recent stop and search figures. Naomi Green, programmes manager with the Northwest Migrants Forum, said the organisation had known for some time that people from minority backgrounds are more likely to be stopped. Amnesty International said the stop and search figures released on Wednesday showed a disproportionate use on people from minoritized ethnic communities and on children. The stop and search figures show 23,650 people were stopped and searched and questioned, a 4% increase on the previous year. People from minoritized ethnic communities almost twice as likely to be stopped and searched, and more than 2,500 children stopped and searched. It's good to get those figures, but they make for well, I was going to say worrying reading, but certainly reading that needs further analysis. Let's go to the Irish Times this morning, and it's a topic that's come up here on a number of occasions, and that's young people vaping, and currently selling vapes to people under the age of 18 is not illegal. But that is looks set to change, because the sale of vaping products to people under 18 will be banned by this summer under plans due to be approved by Cabinet this week. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly will bring a memo to Cabinet tomorrow in which he will outline the full legislation which will be prioritised by government. The new law will ban the sale of e-cigarettes to those under 18 and is expected to be enacted before the Dáil's summer recess in mid-July. Measures in the bill include a restriction on the types of retailers that can sell vapes or nicotine-inhaling products. There will also be measures to curb the advertising of nicotine-inhaling products near schools and a number of other settings frequented by children and young adults. The government's hoping that a ban on advertisement for nicotine-inhaling products near schools and on public transport will limit children's exposures to measures that normally normalise or glamorise vaping. So they might not be as easy to get, and they won't be. There's nothing here about flavours. It's too late for the current generation, who many of them do vape, but hopefully this will prevent younger people into the future vaping, because it's pointless to them. It just gives them a nicotine dependency and can often be a bit of a gateway onto cigarettes or something else. So the sooner that's in place, we're late with it, really, if the truth be told. But the sooner that's in place, I think the majority out there believe the better. As long as adults continue to have access if they need them. The Irish Independent this morning, if you are on a fixed rate mortgage, it's not great news, my apologies, but the European Central Bank is likely to increase its key lending rates two more times before the end of the summer, according to experts. It could be another 2 years before ECB rates start to fall, they've warned now. More rate hikes will affect prospective buyers, switchers and 50,000 homeowners due to come to the end of a fixed rate over the next few years. Borrowers were warned fixed rates are heading for 5.5% in the coming months. Every 1 percentage point rise in a mortgage rate adds around €166 a month, providing they're passed on, of course. That works out at around 2,000 extra a year. Not many people have the capacity to absorb that. There have been 7 ECB rate increases since last summer, with another 2 now expected by September. Experts said the ECB's lending rate was now set to go to 4% after its governing council meets next month. Just switching to page 2 here in the I told you so, we told you so section. You might remember if you were listening last week, we were waiting, myself and Donald, to see how long it would take the newspapers to start telling us that we're going to be hotter than somewhere else. Well, lo and behold, across 2 pages, West is best for hot spell this week as Ireland is set to be warmer than a Costa. So I don't know how warm it's supposed to be over in Costa, but anyway, it's going to be much warmer here. Time to get the sunblock out, I think, because down the south and east, they enjoyed last week warmer weather. We had a lot of cloud cover, but it seems that's not going to be as prevalent this week. So hopefully it gives everyone a lift. Of course, other people, to some it doesn't matter, but I think for the majority of people, when the weather's good, you wake up in the morning and you feel a bit better with what's going on. On to the Irish Daily Mail now this morning, and an average of 10 nurses and midwives are assaulted a day while working, new figures released yesterday show. So that's, you know, they're in the business of caring in hospitals. 10 a day are assaulted, either nurses or midwives. It's figures, according to these figures, more than 62% of assaults reported to the HSE in the first 3 months of the year were carried out against nurses and midwives. Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation General Secretary Phil Nihay said over 848 nurses and midwives were assaulted in the first quarter of this year. This is completely unacceptable. No other profession sees this level of abuse levelled against them. And we do back our nurses and our midwives, and I think we need to back them on this. What is going on? How do people, 10 a day, find it in any way acceptable to level abuse against someone who's trying to make them better? I don't get it, but it's obviously a big problem. On to the Irish Daily Star today, and 7 men are to appear in court in the north this morning charged with the attempted murder of Detective Chief Inspector John Cordwell. Mr. Cordwell was shot several times outside a sports complex in Omagh in Tyrone on February 22nd. He had been coaching a youth football game and was with his young son at the time of the shooting. On Saturday evening, the PSNI said that 2 men aged 28, 5 men aged 33, 38, 45, 47 and 72 have been charged with attempted murder. 2 of the men, aged 38 and 45, were also charged with membership of a proscribed organisation, namely the IRA. 3 of the men, aged 28, 33 and 47, were further charged with preparation of terrorist acts. All 7 of the men charged are expected to appear before Dungannon Magistrates Court via video link, as I mentioned this morning. Right, on to the Sun now. And too many people are being sent to jail for minor offences. What do you think? Often when people comment on sentencing, they believe the sentences are too lenient or that we have a revolving door set up in the prisons. I'm not sure if this is in the same space anyway, but this is what the Justice Minister thinks. He sought to remind district court judges of the suite of options open to them when sentencing. Last month, the Irish Prison Service confirmed there were 4,571 inmates locked up nationwide, well over the jail's official capacity of 4,409 prisoners. It meant some 167 prisoners were sleeping on mattresses on the floor with half of those incarcerated in Dublin's Mountjoy. Well, there's lots of people sleeping in sleeping bags on the streets, but anyway. In addition to his message to judges, the Justice Minister, who is set to step down from the role this week, also defended plans to increase prison capacity. I always thought there had to be quite a separation between politicians and the judiciary, but the Justice Minister is reminding judges of the options available to them. As I say, I'm not sure if that should or shouldn't happen, but it happened anyway. Let's see here now. The Irish Daily Mirror has the latest figures from the RSA as it relates to those of us across Ireland most likely to have penalty points. And motorists from Offaly are more likely to have them than any other county. Almost one in five have been detected committing a road traffic offence over the past 3 years. Figures from the RSA show 19.2% of all drivers in Offaly had endorsements at the end of last December. Overall, just shy of 500,000 or 15% of Irish licence holders had at least one penalty point recorded against them at the end of last year. So where would you say Donegal motorists rank? Would they be the second most likely to have penalty points, the third, the fourth? There's 26 counties. Well, lo and behold, motorists from Donegal are the least likely to have penalty points. The figures show just 11.5% of all licence holders from the county had fallen foul of traffic cops. Now, are we brilliant drivers? Are we safe drivers? Do we stick within the limits? Or is there a detection issue going on here? I don't know what the story is, but Donegal motorists, the least likely of all Ireland, all of the Republic, because these figures don't cover the rest of the Ulster counties outside of the Republic, but we are the least likely. To have penalty points. Okay, that's just some of the stories making the pages today. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Now, we received an email from one of our listeners which reads as follows. My son is 8, has ADHD challenges, for example, stubbornness, in the most positive way possible. He fidgets but doesn't impact in his life. Basically, my son presents as an ADHD child at school and a little bit at home. That put together means that he can't be ADHD in one place and not the other. Therefore, no diagnosis can be made. I'm not looking for a diagnosis because we've been through CAMS and speech and language therapy too. We've eliminated lots and lots of conditions down through the years. Schools are begging for a diagnosis for their own agenda increase of SNA hours, for example. Following 3 comprehensive assessments over 18 months, no ADHD diagnosis can be made. I'm finding the whole experience negative. Negative because school are treating my son like he has additional needs and challenges the system. He's a burden, a hassle. They can't figure him out. School are overwhelmed. I'm constantly hearing negative feedback and it's exhausting, so stressful. Schools are making out that a diagnosis is the solution. For what though? The listener asks. What help is there for my son? There are no options, no solutions to date, none. How can I tell the school to do more? Figure out why my son is challenging at school. Figure out why he doesn't engage well. Apply himself consistently. I asked the school to contact a school psychologist, but nothing has come of that either. It's very frustrating. I don't know what else to do. My back is to the wall. Can anybody advise, please? So we're over opening this up to listeners as well to see what yous have to say. But we have an expert in this area, Avril McMonagle, founder of Mosaic Digital Solutions for Early Education. Thank you so much for joining us this Monday morning, Avril. Good to see you.
You're welcome, Greg. Good to see you too.
Right. Okay. So having run through that correspondence from the listener, what's the initial piece of advice you would offer?
Okay, well, the most important point to make here, Greg, is that children don't actually need a diagnosis now to avail of additional educational supports. And this was changed back in late 2017 with the revised allocation model for children with special educational needs in primary school. Now, this comes with a caveat that none of this conversation is withstanding that, you know, teachers in particular and even early childhood educators in dealing with children now with very diverse needs and support requirements, it is a very challenging landscape. But in 2017, the revised allocation model was developed and put into place exactly for what your listener describes. You know, maybe a child that, and remember, we shouldn't be diagnosing children and giving them labels unless there's something very, very clear cut. Because what was happening previously was children were being pushed to get a diagnosis in order to get special educational needs support in school. And if you have a child, for example, on the autistic spectrum or with ADHD, two different children can require two completely different levels of support. So therefore, it wasn't evidence-based and needs-led from the child's perspective. So the revised model now lets every primary school get an upfront allocation from the Department of Education, which is built on their school profile. And this will enable them to allocate supports to children on a needs-led basis. What they do is, as soon as a difficulty is identified, which you would imagine in this case that you talk about, it has been, an individual plan then, an assessment plan is carried out on that child to identify what additional teaching strategies or supports are needed to help that child to engage with the curriculum. So I really don't understand why this parent is, one, being pushed for a diagnosis, two, that, you know, that a plan is not already in place and that this should be working very closely with the parent.
So just to be clear then, and to address directly one of the parents' claims, can a school apply for and be granted then additional SNA hours or resources without a diagnosis under this new...
Yes, I mean, that's not new. I mean, this revised allocation model was piloted prior to its, you know, generic application in 2017. And reports came back from schools that it was working really, really well because they were able to support children like this who will never maybe have a diagnosis, you know, and nor should they. But at the same time, recognising that these specialist supports may be needed, should this be, and this individual plan then for this child will identify, you know, times that that child might need more support than others. Maybe it's a child that needs support outside, maybe it's emotional regulation stuff, whatever it is. It's pinpointed in this plan, it's shared among teachers, and the allocated hours and resources that each school have then is applied consistently.
Yeah, and you can imagine the frustration of the parent. They're being told, as she described herself, get negative feedback, you know, dreading probably going in for that, but then saying, well, what are we doing here to try and address the situation? This sounds like it's very much in the school's interest to deal with this in a better way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand really why this is happening and why this is the parents' experience. You know, I suppose we have this, you know, historical vision of special educational needs support being, you know, a child with a dedicated person. Now, we now know that that's not always needed. You know, it could be just, you know, there could be certain times that would be challenging for a child, maybe during small group work, that child might need support, but might be great on an individual one-to-one basis. So this is the idea of this evidence-based plan for each child, which teachers are trained how to develop, have got really good guidelines from the Department of Education, you know, in terms of the templates for that, the context of that, how parents are involved. And indeed, if outside professionals need to be involved as well, you know, in terms of like things like speech therapists, educational psychologists, they all would feed into this. But we really are thankfully coming away from that labeling syndrome where a child needs to have a label in order to get support. Supports are wide ranging. They're, you know, very, very broad in terms of what children need and very individualised to the child.
Yeah, just to recap the important paragraph here, parents no longer have to source or pay for assessment for their child to get extra teaching support in school, and schools don't have to wait for these assessments to give children the extra teaching supports they need. Now,
that's right.
It's impossible to imagine that this school is not aware of that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, unless it's some kind of a communication breakdown, you know, between the teacher and. But really, the route for, in terms of your listeners' route for challenging this, would be if the information coming from the teacher is not satisfactory, you then go to the principal, and if that is not satisfactory, you then go to the Board of Governors. So that would be the route for that parent. They seem to be engaging with the class teacher, so maybe it's just time to move that on and get a wee bit of clarity on that.
Yeah, and I think this ties into a conversation we were having last week on a different issue in schools. We maybe go softly or whatever, and we can be really quite defensive, I think, us as parents too, in that environment. You don't think you're going to be, but it's like, you can't say that about my child, you know, that sort of way. But I think we have to take a deep breath and assert ourselves, have the knowledge of what the rules and regs are, and just go in and have a conversation saying, look, I know where we're at here. I know what you should be doing. Can you sort of tell me how you're going to do it now? Because I have that power, I have that knowledge, and I want to work with you towards a resolution and not be afraid to do that.
But as well as that, you know, it's really important that any teaching strategies that are being used within the school are also mirrored at home, because that will, you know, that will strengthen, you know, the support to the child. But we also need to remember as parents that, you know, a special educational needs support doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong with your child. You know, they're very wide ranging. It could be, you know, delayed language development. It could be emotional regulation. It could be any of these things. And we really need to get away from, you know, identifying, you know, a child that has ADHD or, you know, whatever. Look at the child, look at what they need and apply that. And I also know that whilst this special needs allocation is front loaded to primary schools, it is then in place for 2 years. So it's not as if to say, like, you know, they can't be reactive to change. Also, if something dramatically changes within the child profile, there is a mechanism there for them to apply to the Department of Education for an increase in that allocation. Mm. So say, like, for example, a number of children coming from Ukraine and they would need additional language supports and things like that. That can be then, if the profile has changed unexpectedly, there is a mechanism for that. And there's loads of information for both parents and for schools on this in the Department of Education website. And that PDF that I sent you guys on, Greg, you know, feel free to pass that on to
the parent. Yeah, we're certainly going to pass it on to that parent. Yeah,
yeah, because sure. It really outlines it very clearly what her child's entitlements are.
Yeah, and that's a very important word, entitlements. Can I talk a little bit, just before I let you go, about a comment you made as it relates to what we would, as parents or guardians, the home environment versus the school environment, because maybe people see them as two completely different places, but in terms, I suppose, of a child's behaviour and development, we shouldn't view them like that. We need to continue any progress or work that's being done at school. So can you talk to me a little bit about that and its importance?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, this is something that even, you know, in early years education, which happens very strongly, we hear this comment, partnership with parents and engagement with parents. It is one of the most important things about any stage of education, particularly that early phase, you know, up to maybe age 10, that, you know, if you have a child, for example, and there's emotional regulation issues there, you know, a child is suffering from anxiety and certain things trigger that anxiety. Well, the teacher will use a strategy within the class to deal with that trigger and to help that child overcome that. So obviously, it's not rocket science to realise that if the parent also uses that exact same strategy, same with speech and language, you know, if we're looking at, you know, putting interventions in place where we're helping children around pronunciation, around sentence formation, that the strategies that are being used by a speech and language therapist or by the school is mirrored at home. And that's just how children learn. And the two environments have to be valued equally, as equally important.
OK, and very finally, do you know, the way you've outlined it this morning, Avril, it seems that we, certainly in terms of planning, are doing things better, you know, yes, with better outcome from children. From your experience, is it being applied well? In other words, is it working well? I mean, because it sounds like it's the right approach. But I mean, obviously, in Susan's case, there are gaps, and hopefully, we've helped to empower her to plug them. But do you get the sense that it generally is an improvement and is working better for children, and then, of course, their parents and guardians?
Generally get the sense that we're dealing with it better in terms of, and this also goes for early education because we have the access and inclusion model, which would be a similar model for early education. So yes, we're addressing it in a way where we're starting to drop the labels, and we're starting to recognise that all children may need support, even temporarily. I mean, if a child gets support now in this particular year, that's not a given that support will continue right throughout primary education. That's the idea of the evidence-based profile, to make sure that is being led by the child's needs and not some kind of a prior allocation. So yes, certainly the rhetoric, we've got the rhetoric right, Greg. That's all I'll say to you. The paperwork looks good. Obviously, the experience from school to school, it would be naive to think that it's not going to be very different. Yeah. It's going to be very different. But really, more power to the parents. Ask questions, inform yourself in terms of what your child's entitlements are. And if you don't get an answer from that level, go up a level.
Okay. And don't be afraid to do that either. And don't sort of, you know, check yourself and, oh, I don't want to be that. But you have to, because yes, you have to do what's best for you and your child. OK, thanks very much as always, Avril. Take care of yourself. Have a lovely day. Avril McMonagall there, founder of Mosaic Digital Solutions for Early Education. And hopefully that was useful, not just for the person who made it. It's dropped there. Not just for the person that made initial contact, but also there might be other people that's relevant to. Good morning to Marie, Charlie, Michael, Beth, and good morning, Joe, Richard, all watching, along with many, many others across all of our social media and our website. Just to remind you, you can watch the programme every single day live from 9 till 12 on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. That's on your phone, your laptop, your tablet, your smart TV. As I say, most smart TVs now do come with the app loaded, or your Fire Stick. And we're across Facebook too, Highland Radio, or Highland Radio News and Sport. An oxygen machine was found at Main Street, Buncrana. It's now at the Garda station. Please share so we can get it to its owner. That's an unusual thing to find out on the street. It's an oxygen machine on Main Street, Buncrana. The number there to the barracks, do you call them barracks still? Anyway, to the Garda station, 07493 20540. Okay, or contact us, we'll pass that number on to you. Once again, water in Ross Bracken is off this morning. Can anyone explain what's going on? I don't know. And just before the break here, want to mention that a tractor run is taking place on Bank Holiday Sunday, next Sunday. It's in aid of TJ's Wish to Walk. It's €20 per tractor. All tractors are welcome. It starts and finishes at Rosie's Bar there in Drumkeen. Registration is from 1:30, and there'll be a raffle and refreshments afterwards. Okay, coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about calls for, firstly, hospital staff to volunteer to work next weekend, but also the wish of the HSE seems to move the health system to a 7-day week rather than the 5-day week it kind of operates under at the moment. So we've got Paddy Rooney, who's the former Deputy General Manager of Letterkenny University Hospital, to talk about that and, I suppose, to cut through the spin and find out if it's achievable, if it's the right approach. Stay right where you are. Okay, we welcome onto the programme Paddy Rooney, former Deputy General Manager at LUH and current PRO of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. Paddy, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you accepting our invite.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Okay, before we start, I've spoken to you before about the health system operating on a 7-day week, and I know you're an advocate for that, but can you tell us currently how it works and how that can lead to the backups that we see, Paddy?
Greg, it's well established at this stage that there is a problem in this country with timely access to secondary healthcare, and right across all the hospitals in the state. It's not confined to any specific hospital. Some hospitals are worse than others, right enough. But so there's one of two ways that you can fix this, or what needs to be done. There is a process problem and there is a capacity problem. Hospitals up and down the country were, the current setup was sort of originally configured in about, I would say, the 1960s, and they haven't literally changed their mode of working since that. And what that means really is that from about 8:30 to 5:30 every day, the hospital work at full throttle. And then come the evening, then later on in the evening and during the night, then it tampers away down because a lot of the services switch off. And there is a minimal service then that keeps it ticking over on Saturday and Sunday, and then it's back to core again. I mean, it just makes no sense at all that we have so many services within hospitals up and down the country that are switched off for about 110 hours per week, which is incredible. And they're working for about working about 40 hours a week. It just makes no sense at all when there's huge waiting lists.
Can I give one example before you move on? Because, say, for instance, a child's out playing and falls off a slide or something and twists their ankle. They might turn up at Letterkenny University Hospital at 8 or 9 in the evening. But it is the case all the time, but at least some of the time, that the actual, I think it's the purple lane or the purple room or something along those lines, but the actual people and equipment that could assess that, see if it was tendons or a break, would be off at that time and not be back until 7 or 8 in the morning. But often it seems from the correspondence I've got, that's not communicated. So you have people sitting in the ED and because of a lack of information, they're literally wasting their time because they'll never be called because the team or the equipment to assess an injury like that is not there. Is that a kind of an example of what we're talking about?
Well, I'm not hugely familiar about the language about the purple lane and so on and so forth, because I'm retired now 5 years, so that.
No, I'm not quite sure of it either, but anyway.
Yeah, but that's fair enough. Because the problem is, you see, that the first thing is because hospital consultants aren't rostered for 24/7 working like some other disciplines within the hospital. You may be dealing with a junior hospital doctor, right? So because the consultants are what's called on call outside of core hours. And then there are certain diagnostics in within the hospital that aren't available either. So you may very well have to wait, if it's not completely urgent, of course, with the capital U. Because it would be nice, for instance, if the hospital was functioning on a Saturday and Sunday the same way as it does on a Monday and Tuesday. But of course, it doesn't do that. There are lots of professions within the hospital, of course, that are contractually obliged to work what we call 5/7. That means they're rostered 5 days a week, but over a 7 day period. And you're talking about junior hospital doctors, nursing staff, a whole range of support services like, catering, cleaning, portering, domestic and so on, clerical admin in certain areas like admission and reception. But then you have a whole raft of professions within the hospital that don't do, that are not rostered 5/7. And that's all the multidisciplinary team that work across traditional 5 day week services like outpatients, like day surgery, endoscopy, oncology, professions allied to medicine, lots of diagnostics and so on. And it's just incredible that all those, that capacity is not there. Of course, when Caroline spoke to me a couple of days ago or yesterday about coming on your program, I got the impression with sort of the language that she was using to me about things like choice and uptake and so on and so forth. We cannot be talking about stretching what we have at the moment for 5 days and putting it over 7 days, because you won't get anywhere with that. I mean, if you take somebody in general terms, any profession at all within the hospital that works a 37-hour week, if you want to stretch that 37 hours over 7 days rather than 5 days, you've actually gained nothing. Mm. And I'll give you an example. I put my hand into the barrel of apples here, and I'll pick out just two cases in at random. Let's talk about hospital consultants, for instance, who are currently not rostered to work over a 7 day. They work core hours, and then there's one person on call and outside of that. And hospital consultants, their contract is such that they do 3.5 hour sessions per week, right? So in principle, you're able to pick out where each individual consultant is at any moment in time, right? And that's divided into things like ward rounds, outpatient sessions, day case, theatre if they have access to that kind of stuff, teaching of junior doctors, which they're contractually obliged to do. There's a session for admin that might be meeting families and case conferences and stuff like that. And then they're contractually obliged then to sit on certain clinical committees within the hospital. Now, if you want the consultant to work on a Saturday and Sunday, If they're off on a Monday and Tuesday and they transfer that to Saturday and Sunday, you've actually gained nothing because the capacity has been lost. This has to be about more, Greg. It can't be about different.
Okay, so pardon my ignorance, and this is ignorance. Now, there probably isn't a crossover then with consultants. Someone might say, well, can we not have consultants work, let's have a Monday and Tuesday off and work a Saturday and Sunday, and then another consultant switch around with them? Do you know, you might see in a different working environment. So tell me why that wouldn't be a solution to this problem.
Well, it would, on condition that you're talking about filling in the gaps there. I mean, what? Because if you're talking about filling in the gap for a Monday and Tuesday, are you talking about somebody new or are you talking about taking a consultant from somewhere else?
Yeah, because no matter
what way you want to do. The other example I was going to give you then is just one of random would be radiology, for instance. So the radiology manager has around 7 individual modalities to cover. And I'm talking about CT, MRI, ultrasound, and so on and so forth. And they're all, there's a lot of subspecialties in those areas. So because they, each of those modalities are covered. So the current manager is a female, so she covers all of those. And each of the staff then is entitled, would say, for instance, 6 weeks holiday. So you might have 3 staff in the department that are permanently on annual leave because it's predominantly female service. There's maternity leave, sick leave, annual leave, and other kinds of leave. So if you want to spread that service, all of those modalities out over 7, there is no point in taking away from Monday and Tuesday, put into Saturday and Sunday, because you've lost capacity. Suddenly then, Greg, it's all about window dressing. And there's a perception here we have a 7-day-week service, but we don't really.
So, and when I heard, like Tony Canavan has referenced this in the past, and I'm not going to quote him because I don't want to misquote him, but talking about exploring ways of moving to the 7-day-week, I didn't really hear it phrased like you are, Paddy, in that we really need to start ramping up our hiring of consultants then, because that's what would be required. Do you know what I mean? I hope, and I'm going to separate it now from Tony Canavan. I hope we don't have a situation whereby, rather than talking about how we do this, the HSE kind of pitches the public versus against hospital staff, thinking, "Oh, you have it handy, you don't want to work weekends." When the actual what we need is more people employed in key positions.
Yeah, because I'm after saying earlier on about all of the staff, for instance, that are working over a 7-day period anyway, I think from about 2010 onwards, most if not all of the contracts that staff have signed have actually, they're 5/7 contracts anyway. Now, they might not be implemented, of course, they still might be working 5/5, but they've signed contracts to that. I mean, if we're talking about taking the current capacity and just spreading that out over 7 days, no matter what way you dice it, Greg, you have to reduce the capacity of the days of the week. I mean, if staff work 37 hours on a 5-day week, if you have the same, it takes 56 hours to cover it over 7 days, you know, and no matter what way you want to dice this, that's another 18 hours or whatever it is. You have to do that. Because the prize is huge here. For instance, there is a lot of clamour from various quarters like the Irish Hospital Consultants Association and the nursing unions and opposition politicians about putting extra beds in the system, right? And nobody for one moment is talking about putting in beds in the system without putting in the staff to do it. I mean, my premise is here that we're doing this the wrong way around. We're putting extra beds in the system, but we're not going to change the whole processes around it. I mean, I would much prefer to see efficiencies around using the beds we have at the moment in a more efficient manner. I mean, just to give you an example now, we're sort of moving away slightly from it, but it's relevant here, is that today is Monday, and it's traditionally, I think, one of the worst days of the week for hospitals up and down the country because of the lack of capacity or action over the weekend. But you might have something over 700 patients that are warehousing in hospitals now up and down the country, Greg, because they've been medically discharged by consultants because they're still there. There's nowhere for them to go. Let's say, for instance, if all those 700 were miraculously discharged tomorrow, that's actually the capacity of 2 brand new hospitals the size of Letterkenny University hospitals in the system. And I mean, the next time that Peter O'Rourke is on your programme, you should ask him, what would his professional life have been like if he could get same-day access to any diagnostic or any professional allied to medicine assessment? If he could get it in the same day, he would tell you he would probably still be working in the hospital.
No, I think so.
His life would be so great.
Yeah, I think
but
you're
you don't
right,
have it. So they're the things that need to be done. And you need 7-day-week service, but you can't take from Monday and Tuesday, mm-hmm. not into Saturday and Sunday, because you've actually gained nothing.
Right, so how do we go then, Paddy, how do we go from a situation that seems to be whereby we're struggling to retain consultants? Some consultants are coming up, having a look around effectively for 2 or 3 weeks and then taking other options elsewhere and difficulty in attracting them. So how do we go from having a problem in retaining consultants to actually reversing that and then recruiting more in consultants to allow us to do, say, for instance, to run the hospital over 7 days? What needs to infrastructurally change within the health system to go from that point A to point B? Because it seems a massive gap to bridge.
Well, remember now I'm out of the system for about 5 years, but from the little bit I know about it here, the problem seems to be a frustration with a lack of support. And that's, there's no point saying that this is an internal hospital problem, because it's a sort of a national attitudinal problem. Contracts of employment for hospital consultants and all the other professions within the hospital are all agreed, Greg, at national level. Local management have little or no input to them at all, because a consultant contract in Donegal is the very same as a consultant in Cork, and it's the very same as one in Dublin. And, I heard your discussion, was it last week or the week before that, about the consultant endocrinologist in the hospital and the massive caseload. And on top of all of that, then, the way that the contract is set up is, not alone does he or she have to cover their core hours during the week in a massive, but they actually have to do their turn on call as well. It's actually worse than the way that it's been portrayed, because on call then means that you could have a quiet night, or you could be in the hospital for 12 hours during the night, and then you have to come back in at 8 o'clock in the morning to do a clinic that day. That's all set up nationally. Local management have no input to that whatsoever. And when you couple that with a frustration then in relation to access to diagnostics, is the big one with a very capital D. That's what's the frustration, and I think that a lot of consultants have up and down the country, not confined to Letterkenny, actually.
Yeah, all right. And finally, we have the HSC Chief Bernard Gloucester, I beg your pardon, writing to staff, asking them to take on extra shifts this bank holiday weekend to avoid the dreadful position hospitals were left in following recent long weekends. To me, I mean, maybe he has no choice. It smacks a bit of desperation, really, because you're going back to the same well, I suppose, for assistance in fixing a problem that's perhaps running dry.
Yeah, and because we're coming in now to the summer months, there's going to be a lot of bank holiday month, and there's a lot of new people coming into the country as well, tourists and so on and so forth, so the population of the country increases. I mean, that's fine. Yeah, we were talking about when things were very bad in the month of January and February, that the CEO at the time was asking hospital consultants to come in and work at the weekend. But right, so that's a Monday and Tuesday. You fix the bank holiday, but then it's as if everything sort of calms down on a Wednesday and Thursday, but it doesn't, Greg. It's now crazy. I remember Sean Murphy, the general manager, was on your programme earlier this year, and he referenced Stephen's Day, or Boxing Day, as we call it. And traditionally, when I was in the hospital, that used to be a very, very quiet day. I can't remember what day it was. Boxing Day might have been on a Tuesday. And the level of attendance at the emergency department that day was the same as every other Tuesday.
Yeah.
That's the way it is now. It's just full on every day a week. No quiet days anymore.
Yeah. All right. Listen, Paddy, thanks so much as always for your insight into all of this. We really do appreciate you accepting the invite, and have a lovely day. Thank you so much indeed.
Okay, same.
Paddy Rooney, former Deputy General Manager there of Letterkenny University Hospital. He's been out of it now, as you heard from him, a few years, but still has a wonderful insight. Current PRO of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. And just trying in that conversation, really, to separate the woods from the trees. And, when we hear things on the news, what does it actually mean? Or what are they actually asking for? Or what's the reality of the situation? So hopefully, it certainly was an education for me. Hopefully that's helped us all have a better understanding of what's what. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll be back shortly. By the way, Lisa Hone from the Mike Action Group was due to be on with us before 10, and I know it was flagged on social media, so if you've tuned in for that, please come back. Don't go anywhere, but Lisa's going to be joining us at 10:15. because we don't want to rush it, and we only have a couple of minutes before 10. Well, we've plenty of time for comments, but it's such a serious, when it's an important issue, I like to afford a bit more time. Greg, basically, as a non-medical person, says this listener, what we obviously need is extra staff in all departments in hospitals, and that's it. And that's why we wanted to get Paddy on, because, you know, it's all right sort of saying spread the 5 days to seven, but that means probably, what, an extra 20% staff? I mean, that's a guesstimation. I don't know what it is, but it certainly requires more staff. Greg, Paddy is right. If the kitchen was closed down from Friday evening to Monday morning, there'd be no food for the patients. Yeah, indeed. A caller says his wife was in Letterkenny University Hospital having a baby in the last few days, and they could not fault a single member of staff in the maternity ward. They were all extremely helpful and could not do more for people, particularly the midwife. And indeed, they're amazing right across the hospital, particularly, as many of you would know, we were in there a couple of years ago and we just got the best of treatment. And we're having these conversations, and I'll just reiterate this again, it's to stand with the hospital, not against it, okay? So it's to try and support the staff, to get more investment, to get more staff, to make their jobs and lives more better, if you know what I mean, the working environment. It's never, ever a criticism of staff. And I think most of the people working in the hospital get that we're there sort of trying to improve things, not to sort of suggest that they're not doing a good job. The SNA scheme needs to be properly advertised to schools. My son was diagnosed with ADHD. His primary teacher stated he didn't have time to give him one-to-one support and instead gave him a tablet, sat him in the corner. The special needs class involved taking him to CAFS for a sandwich rather than working on maths. Interestingly, the same teacher has all the time in the world to assist the Ukrainian children. In my son's case, I set aside time to help him with his homework. I discovered that he's well able to do the work with 10 to 15 minutes help. He's now gone on to secondary school and does his own study and homework, and looks like he'll do well in his junior cert. The primary school let him down. Hopefully things have changed a little bit, but great to hear that he is doing well. My child's Drumcondra tests last year were 1 and 2. I was told she would be taken out for learning support 30 minutes every day, which only happened up until Christmas. Since then, she's been lucky to help get help one day per week. It's quite obvious to me that unless you have your child assessed privately, then your child is not guaranteed the support daily. Unfortunately, these assessments are between 600 plus. Not everyone can afford this option. But as we heard from Avril, the school is letting you down there because it does not require you to go through that assessment program. That changed a number of years ago. So again, and maybe we need to make this PDF available on our website or somewhere for parents to look at, you should not have to go and get assessment the way you should or the way you have in order to get the treatment that you believe you're not the treatment, the assistance that your child needs. Families should not be broken up either, says this listener. If two children from the same family are going to school and one is autistic, they both need to be able to go to the same school. Another, I travelled down to Dublin and had a CT scan carried out on Saturday morning in a private hospital. Steady stream of patients booked in for scans all day. Why not in the public system? And on a different issue here, Greg, water is off again in Pluck. Second time in 3 to 4 days, sick to death with it. I'd imagine so. Why is Lisa home from Mag pushing Coleman Legal when she knows a large number of us can't avail of this? I didn't get my blocks from the main supplier, neither did all my neighbours. There is no justice here. Well, that is going to be parked to one side here. I don't think she's pushing it. I think what she's saying is perhaps the best option for many, but I'm not going to speak in her behalf because she'll join me after 10, but I'll put that point to her. Okay.